Hi there. Welcome to the next episode of whatever the show's called. This week, I'm liking the title, Stand Up and Get Down with Scott Capurro. So we may call it that, but again, I'm dealing with lawyers right now in the U.S., so it may never air. If you hear this, it means either that you're lucky or I'm dead. So welcome, and please welcome my next guest, Mark Gatiss. I just saw Barbara Streisand in Hyde Park, obviously, 3 weeks ago.
Just exercising. Yeah, we're
just running laps.
Babs.
But she sang "The Man That Got Away." That was her final encore. I got so gay at that moment. Because you know, she mentioned Judy, and a lot of the audience didn't know that Judy sung that, or didn't know her rendition of it, or that it was added to the film because it needed to be the second version of A Star Is Born. Mm-hmm. And Streisand ripped it. And I'd heard, we kind of went, because I've seen her live before, obviously. And I thought it might be a bit of a freak show. And I'd heard that she couldn't sing anymore. But
she can.
Oh. She sang for 3 hours.
Wow.
With Lionel Richie. Hello.
I feel like I've stopped. I'm less gay for not going. I think it was one of those things.
She was calling your name out.
Yeah.
And then... And there's a throne with your name over it just waiting for you. But it was so strange because we got the cheap seats because we thought we could upgrade when we got there and then choose where we wanted to sit. But all the upgrades were gone by like 4 p.m.
Yeah.
And then...
All the gays.
Uber
gays.
And then we were standing sort of in a good spot near the more expensive VIP area. And all the people coming out of there, the minute she started singing, loads of people came out to use the toilet, I guess. They were so drunk. People were being carried out by the police because of fights, I guess. And one woman was missing all of her teeth. I mean, with wine stains all, really trashy. Wow. I'm like, how do they afford it? Doesn't seem right. The whole world turned upside down. But it also made me think, you know, you can never second guess an audience because you would think that Streisand's audience would be completely devoted.
Yeah.
But some people were just there for the screwdrivers, I think. And
maybe it's not so much the profile as just people who want to go to a big gig or get freebies for a big gig and don't really give a monkey's hoof.
Yeah, maybe company freebies and stuff.
Maybe they're just Yentl fans. Very specific or something like that.
Very few of those, though. I count myself amongst them, however. I can't imagine there were 65,000 of those, but have you enjoyed that film, Yentl?
I enjoyed that film. I have enjoyed it.
God. Papa has heard me so many times singing that song.
I got also very nostalgic watching the new Star Is Born, the 38th version.
Well, that's why I brought it up, because I read what you said about it.
Yeah, I really, really liked it. But I was very struck by how much Lady Gaga reminded me of a young Babs.
But you went along with low expectations, I think you said, in the interview I read with you.
I didn't really fancy it.
Right.
I was in Nottingham doing the Matters to George III last year, and my husband came up for his birthday. And we said, let's go and see A Star Is Born.
He must be young because he still celebrates that. That's so sweet. How adorable.
A birthday.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
And it was, I don't know, maybe I would have got around to see it. But I was, from the get-go, I thought it was really well done.
I thought he was marvelous.
Yeah. And I didn't even know he directed it until to the end.
The only thing that bothered me is when he answered the door with his shirt off and I thought, oh, yeah, that's what alcoholics look like. That's the only part that I had a hard time with.
Ones I know.
Yeah, all the drunks that I've knocked on their door. Well, listen, let me do your... good afternoon. We're at the marvelous Top Secret in the glamorous Drury Lane area.
It's a dreary lane today, isn't it?
It is literally, yeah.
It's pouring down.
It actually was dreary before this venue opened here. There used to be very little activity down here, but it's all kicked off this area. And on a nice day, it's nice. But no, it's London summer. And thankfully, Mark Gatiss has made it down. We're very appreciative. He's an English actor, if you don't know, a screenwriter, novelist, and a comedian. He's part of the brilliant comedy trio League of Gentlemen, which is when I first
quartet,
saw Mark.
Please, quartet.
The quartet, sorry. But the performance trio. But the performance quartet as well on the road, right?
Go on.
Well, the comedy group. The comedy melange. And then Mark wrote with Stephen Moffat the TV series Sherlock, which he also stars currently as the scheming brother I don't have my glasses on. Who am I trying to kid? God damn it.
It's so ridiculous. It's so embarrassing at the moment.
Keep this in.
Why are you wearing any?
I've got mine here because I'm not reading anything. Otherwise, I'd have four pairs on.
Are you near or far? Or
oh, that sounds like a lyric. I'm far.
Yeah, you're far. Yeah, me too. Anyway, he plays a scheming brother, as we all know, Mycroft Holmes, on the marvelous series Sherlock, which is yet to enter its fifth season, I think.
Yes, not going anywhere fast, I'm afraid.
Right. Right. And the fans are, they're seething with anticipation, I think.
Well.
He's also helped write Doctor Who and has been a great part of the reinvigoration, both of that series and, of course, of Sherlock. And some might say that these characters before Mark got involved in both those series had grown a bit stale and flat. And with his help, something like Sherlock now plays in 185 countries in the world, with only 196 recognized by the United States as the official nation.
I don't know if it's in South Sudan yet.
Yeah, no. I just worked with a South Sudanese comic.
Did you?
In Budapest 2 nights ago. And he was quoting Sherlock, so you're probably wrong. Anyway, Mark appeared on the Game of Thrones in a part whose name is unpronounceable. He played a banker or a villain, which is kind of the same thing in this modern world. Mark is from Durham County. The internet lists Mr. Gatiss as working class. But of course, he's now richer than Oprah. Sherlock, as I said, plays all over the world. Mark's been acting live in theater and also in film for the last 20 years. Please welcome the fabulous Mark Gatiss. Thank you so much.
Thank you. There's no audience to applaud.
Well, you know, I found that if we have an audience, we never have had, this is our fourth one, and we talked about an audience, but I think we had Omid Shalili on the show, and he kind of made it, he put it right. It's like, with an audience, it turns into a performance, and I want it to be more of a conversation.
Good.
Although...
Well, we could put like a Scooby-Doo style... Horrible.
Oh,
laugh,
no, we do.
A laugh
yeah.
to try, really repetitious, obvious laugh.
With one person in the laugh that stands out, like in the Mary, like Rhoda used to have. The one guy that went, ha, ha, ha.
Rhoda had a laugh track?
Oh, yeah, you're sweet.
Hello, this is Carlton, your doorman. Valerie Harper's very poorly.
Oh, no.
There's a crowdfunding thing, apparently.
Oh, last time I saw
Jesus,
you
I love that show. One of the great shows, that.
Well, Mary Tyler Moore show.
Yeah. Well, all of them, actually.
But I mean, I still watch when I get sad or uninspired. I watched old episodes of those on the internet. So, the Bob Newhart show, too. Genius. Because they're all character. Well, maybe you find them marvelous. I mean, I like them in a way because they feel like a lot of the characters remind me of my childhood. I have a lot of memories around them. We'll talk more about planning our weekends around TV because I read that you used to do that when you were a kid, too. But maybe for you, because so much of your writing, as I've read and seen, is character conflict and character-based. And those shows were. And so much of TV now seems to be either about people torturing one another. I can't watch television anymore. I can't watch people getting their knees sawed off. Or it's about people being mean to one another in comedy, which I know is ridiculous for me to be offended by that. But
wait a minute.
I know, but are there... I mean, why did you decide to update, not just update, but modernize Sherlock? I mean, there's something so tempting about him being in Victorian Britain with all those marvelous murders to choose from. So many that go far beyond Whitechapel. You know, I was reading about other murders from the Victorian times. They're quite famous. His obviously eclipsed all of them. But that look, that period, that foggy London, those marvelous, like, fuzzy lapels.
We just had enough. Stephen and I always loved Sherlock Holmes since we were kids. And, you know, I second to none, as you know, in loving all forms of Victoriana and Edwardian horror and crime. And I love all that. Of course I do. It's meat and drink to me. But it came about really quite accidentally. We were on a train. We were both working on Doctor Who. And we started talking about Sherlock Holmes. And we sort of slyly... admitted to each other that our favorite versions were the Basil Rathbone films.
Marvelous. Yeah, fantastic.
Which are, there are 14 of them, but 12 of the 14 are actually set in the then present day. They're set fighting the Nazis.
Oh, right.
And they're sort of generally regarded as sacrilegious, but they're wonderful. They've got so much of the spirit of the original stories. And then I said, isn't it funny that we were in the middle of a new Afghan war.
Oh, right.
With the Allies had invaded Afghanistan. The most recent. And I said, isn't it funny that
in the original, the first story, Study in Scarlet, Dr. Watson is invalided home from the Afghan War.
Oh, right.
In the biopic, this is the scene on the train in which the light bulb goes off, and I turned to Steve and said, "You know, so we should do that again. Someone should do that again."
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the moment we thought, oh, you know, you could do that. And then it became like a, well, it's essentially like a flat share sitcom.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Two
yeah.
mismatched bachelors, one of whom is a very strange young man, and the other guy, the doctor, doesn't know what he does. Just some strange people keep traipsing through the front room. He says, "Can I have the front room for a bit?"
Yeah, yeah.
And he doesn't know, and then he becomes absolutely intrigued by him. Then eventually finds out he's a consulting detective, the only one in the world. And so many things fell into place immediately, which became very exciting. Just literally blowing away that Victorian fog and getting back to them as characters, not as trappings. And that was what was deeply appealing to us, was that they are the two most unlikely but closest friends in fiction.
They have a man crush on one another too. Yeah, or they seem
definitely.
To.
I mean, there's a wonderful line in one of the stories when they go out for a walk, and Watson says, "So we walk for the most time in silence, as befits two men who know each other intimately," which I think is exactly what that is. You know, they don't have to sort of perform,
right?
They just know each. They just sit in silence because they know each other. But there's a really great sort of. It's one of the great friendships in literature, and is the starting point for almost all detective fiction. It really is. Doyle acknowledged the influence of Poe in a rather brilliant way by having Sherlock Holmes slag him off at the beginning, but after that, you draw lines from Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson to every single Poirot and Hastings, every buddy cop. It's all there.
Yeah.
And we got very excited about that, and about the idea of starting again in a way that is almost never done, which is them as really very young men in their 30s, that because Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson are almost always in middle age when we first meet them.
Mm.
And so starting again was the great... impetus to do it.
But and you wrote a role for yourself on that show. Did you ever fantasize yourself as the Basil Rathbone character, having watched him as a child? I mean, did you ever impersonate that character, voice for yourself, and ever imagine that someday you might be maybe playing him?
No, I mean, I used to play at Sherlock Holmes. I had a pipe. I had all those things. I remember I won a prize at school for a painting called The Great Detective. I wish I had a picture of that now. I absolutely loved Sherlock Holmes, and it's all inextricably linked with a love of horror and ghost stories, and because you know there's a lot of horror in Sherlock Holmes a lot of, you know, foggy moors. One of the very best of the Rathbones is called The Scarlet Claw, set in Canada, but it's essentially a remake of Harry and the Baskervilles. But it's sort of it's about a supernatural, what appears to be a supernatural killer. It's really good, and it's a Universal movie, so it draws on all the sorts of flavors and of the Frankenstein movies. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of the same people in it, so I love all that stuff.
Yeah, when you tell people that, for instance, when you met your husband for the first time, and you went on your first date and told your top 10 stories, whatever they are, to impress somebody across the table. Do you alert people that you know well or not well that you're a horror fan? And does that ever push people off a little bit, do you think? Because when I was growing up, I used to watch all that stuff. That was the only stuff that was on TV in a way, because the old films.
Yeah.
And like you say in an interview, I think somewhere, that the Great Depression was a boon for horror.
Yeah, very much.
In the film industry. And so a lot of those great movies, Frankenstein, et cetera, were made in that period. I mean, when I was a kid, I didn't find them that scary, really. But I found them alluring. Mm. And there's something about, I think, the men, the lead men, for instance, the doctor in Frankenstein, something about him creating and controlling his world that was very tempting to me. So when you tell people that horror is something for you that you find almost refreshing, how do you explain that to people?
Well, you're right. I mean, there's often that thing people go, "No, I can't watch horror films." And I'm always amazed at the strange diversity of people who really wouldn't expect to have a lot of grown men, as it were, get very scared.
Yeah.
And I always, you know, my counter is it's a great pleasurable thrill. I think it's like a roller coaster thing. It's the flip side of a good laugh, a great scare. In fact, when you go to the cinema and watch a good horror film,
the thing that happens after everyone screams is everyone laughs.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Straight away.
Or,
Because there's a huge reaction to it. And I think that's part, it's part of the same fun. I, like you, though, you know, my tastes have changed massively. I can't bear most things. I'm terribly squeamish.
About horrible violence, it looks real. I can't do it. Oh, if a zombie's eating a zombie, I can watch that.
Yeah.
But I can't watch someone take three bullets in the head. I can't.
No, but do you know what I find? To me, that's not horror. I like supernatural horror. So the ones I really can't bear are home invasion films. I think because I'm afraid it might happen. That's true horror. No, that terrifies me. The idea of like someone breaking into your house and putting a gun to your loved one's heads or something like that, or torturing you.
The torture that, stuff.
It's terrifying.
Like hung by your ankles on the road. You know,
And I don't know what that says about us, why that's become where we are.
People watch it on their phones at the gym while they're on the treadmill. I see it over the shoulder. I'm like, are you? Please put that. You just the noise, the sound that's created by it.
But then, but you know, that's part of getting old as well. And also, there's a lot of that is the youthful bloodlust. I was a very bloodthirsty child, and I'm not like that anymore. I just can't bear it. I find even stuff that is quite mild quite difficult sometimes these days. And I've retreated very much into. I love ghosts the most, and I like a good scare. I really don't like gore.
Well, people beating people up, and so much of that. But I feel like if there is, in that same film, a character that I can in some way attach myself to, it doesn't have to be a good person, but, you know, I mean, I loved The Sopranos when it first started, even The Sopranos, but as that series continued, all the characters were so disparaging that I couldn't connect to anything. And they were so violent.
Do you find...
The writing was so good, but I just... In season 3 or 4, I just lost my
way. But don't you find that... I mean, this is a lot to do with being a whoopsie, isn't it, as well? That you find yourself identifying with the oddest people, you know, in any given show or any given film. I mean, I could talk about this forever, but I have such vivid memories of... I've written about this, but... The horror films used to be on Friday night, where I'm from in County Durham. It was called Appointment with Fear.
And on television?
On TV. Friday night is where horror films still belong, and I still watch them on Friday nights, and it recreates in a sort of Proustian way. It really does. The little thrill, going to watch a Hammer tonight. and then in the summer, there was a kind of break, but I used to routinely be left on my own to watch horror movies when I was growing up. And then suddenly they were off, and there was a film. It just said in the Northern Echo, it said, "If 5 stars, Lindsay Anderson, don't miss." And I was just left on my own. And I watched If, and in the first 5 minutes of the film, as the boys are coming back from holidays, there's this incredibly beautiful blonde boy with a big quiff, and one of the prefects hits him across the shoulder and says, "Stop tarting, Phillips." And I got an erection. And I spent the rest of the evening terrified that someone would come down. I mean, and those moments are very much embedded in my head. And then in horror film, I remember first time I saw The Bride of Frankenstein, which is an extraordinary movie, you know, and not really a horror film, a sort of camp delight, extreme black comedy.
Yeah.
But in amongst all the weirdness and the Grand Guignol and the Elsa Lanchester and everything, you have Ernest Thesiger, who is the screaming queen Hollywood ever produced, and it's just there apologetically. You know?
But they used to put screaming queens in horror. I think.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they're both comic relief, but also they could get away with it in a horror film
because
it was seen like so extreme and so strange that everything was weird. So why not
have
that
some
too?
Gin? It's my only weakness. That's what he says.
I used to map. Like Abbott and Costello, I used to watch all that. And then anything that had music in it, I would watch when I was a child. And really, I would stay home all week. In California, everyone was out, like, you know, digging trenches and riding their bikes and, you know, flashing one another. And I was lying on carpet near the fireplace watching films. And I'm sure that there's something about that that to my mother seemed strange. And I know that she held me back and didn't hold me back, but they wanted to skip a grade with me. And she said, "I won't let them because your social skills are underdeveloped." That's a memory I have of my weekends watching films when I was a kid.
Because you weren't allowed out, because you didn't go out to play.
Mm. Oh, and because I...
Did you have a special friend who came around?
Shut up. I had... his name was Scott. I'm blushing now. He's my neighbor, Scott Coppett. But anyway...
Another Scott.
Another Scott. Oh, and his mother, his grandmother and mother were sort of indigent. And they didn't know where he was half the time. We were... next door neighbors. I would go up into the hills and dig tunnels with him, and we'd wrestle.
Is that what they call it?
That's what we still call it that. But just, you know, wider tunnels. But no, we would play, you know, Stratego, all these games, and or Stratego, what it was called. And Battleship, I'd sink his battleship. And we'd wrestle in our underwear. Anyway, so yes, part of it was my mother. But I mean, do you think that in some way that your family watched your behavior and thought, we can leave him on his own, he's a bit odd, he needs to catch up? Did you feel in a way apart from, because you're such a part of, I wouldn't say mainstream culture, but you're such a part of modern contemporary culture right now.
Did it take you being sort of on your own and sort of to develop kind of who you were as a child to become that person? I mean, did you feel apart? I definitely did.
Yeah, yeah. I had really one really good friend at school. Mm. I was in primary school. David Clegg was my best friend. We were sort of inseparable.
Are you friends now?
No, I haven't seen him for years. But
because he runs the Labour. No, I'm thinking Nick Clegg anyway.
Yeah. And I mean, it was. I mean, I wasn't unsociable. It's just like we were so alike.
Mm.
We just talked about horror. It was horror. Every Doctor Who, horror movies, everything. And so he was just my best friend. And then at secondary school, I suppose I was a lot more sociable. I never felt sort of lonely.
Mm.
I had a brother and a sister, and I felt different in this. Yeah, I mean, I was different in the sense that my interests were always, you know, historical and odd. And my mum used to say I was morbid because I used to do exactly that. I used to stay in with the curtains drawn.
Mm.
Try, you know, there's probably a word somewhere for trying to watch the TV with too much sunshine on it. You know that? It still happens to this day. You can't quite get it dark enough.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In when it's blazing July.
Yeah.
And I suffered from that.
Yeah.
But I did. I remember, I loved playing out. I remember very particularly that. It sounds like such a middle-aged thing to say, but it's true, because we used to, you know, you'd open the door in the summer and we'd go out, run out, and then we'd come back to be fed like animals
right.
at the end of the day. That was the last they'd ever seen of us, because we just used to run wild, really.
But perhaps you've always sounded, you have such a lovely speaking voice, and I know you've been told that before, but perhaps you've always sounded like this as a child. Perhaps you've always spoken sort of this way, more beyond your years when you were young.
Maybe, yes. I mean, I had my mum used to say I had an old soul.
Mm.
And I think that's kind of true. I was always very interested in the past. And I used to love hanging out with old people.
Well, you were very close to your mother, weren't you?
Yeah. And I remember when I was very little, she used to organize sort of pensioners sing-alongs. And I loved going to stuff like that, singing songs from the war. She said, you've been here before. But and old movies, and I love... So there are certain black and white movies that always give me a real rush, because I remember watching them with my mum, and sort of Sunday afternoon kind of treat, you know. But yeah, I felt different, but I didn't feel like a kind of an outsider in that. I didn't feel like I was the only one.
I felt like until I found drama class at the age of 16 in high school. But before that, I felt like I was sort of not an outcast. I had a couple of friends, like you said, but being in drama in my sophomore year, it's a 4-year program, my second year in high school, I think people decided, oh, wait, you're not weird or creepy. You're that funny guy from drama class.
Yeah,
they
kind of
put me in a pigeonhole and then knew how to respond to me. Do you think that getting involved in performance in the arts helps you.
And there's a moment, isn't there? There's a moment I remember this sort of happening when you felt like your time had come. Hmm. Having been, you know, I always used to look at the boys I used to fancy, the jocks in the back of the class, who, there's another word that has yet to be coined for what that kind of boy looks
Two
like.
Two words we need now, yeah, the sun on the screen.
And now
maybe it's the same word. Would that be
It's that, you'll know exactly what I mean. It's the boys who don't realize that this is their moment, and it's never going to get any better. They are king of the world,
yes,
and they can have any girl in the class, and there's something like indescribably perfect about them for about 18 months.
Mm.
And then when you see them at Christmas, when you go home, they're about 40 stone. And you think, I think I've weathered okay.
And you think, I can drive a car now too anyway, I don't need your help. No, I remember those boys. And some of them stayed okay. I was always attracted
I was always attracted to either the foreign exchange student.
Oh, God, yes.
Always. Or I always liked the Jewish chatty kid. We had a couple of those when I was in school. And I just, the funny kids that would make me laugh walking on the way home. Of course, the guys on skateboards that commuted to school on a skateboard and then play tennis all day long. Amazing. That guy.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember his name. Frank Jakes had a French last name. And we hit bumped at the school dance. But I don't remember a lot of things about
God.
Him.
Yeah.
But that was erotic. I think for me, emotionally or intellectually, it's more about, even at that time, it was more about conversation. And I still know that if my husband didn't make me laugh, he just made me laugh this morning, I wouldn't be with him. Mm-hmm. He said to me this morning, "Kapoor, I'm good at everything except making money." And that made me laugh because we were in bed complaining about money. And and it's also a lie. He's not good at everything.
Of
Kapoor. Because when you say Scott in Portuguese from Brazil, it sounds like Scotch. We realized that on our first date. So he's called me by my last name ever since.
That's
and
so
he also knows almost nothing about me, so it's appropriate. But I don't let him in. You know, you did say, again, a lot of what I know about you, the personal stuff, is from years ago, because we don't really travel in the same circles now, because you're award-winning. But but a lot of what I've read about you and seen about you online, I think I mentioned this vaguely when I texted you, was interviews. And there's almost no, other than the TV stuff people can see anytime, there's no live performance videos of you online. There's very few, almost none, really. And so what I'm going to bring up during the interview, if you're uncomfortable, tell me. But I think it's all common information that you can see online. But you did say in one interview, and you spoke about it really intimately, the best family time you remember, your best memories are when your mother was passing away and how much closer it seemed to bring you at that time. And then your sister passed away soon after that, too. I don't know what year that was for you. Is it 2016 that your mother?
My sister was 2010.
2010. Oh, then it's been.
Yeah.
Then when your mother, what year was that?
2002.
Oh, right. My mother was 2009. And my mom and I were very close too. And so many things that happen still, I run through my mother's voice in my head or hear her laughing about it. And so many off the cuff remarks I make are in the voice of my mother, I realize that. And I just mentioned that I did a show in Budapest, and one of the comics who watched me, the people I was with, we all watched each other, very sweet. We didn't have a choice. It was theater in the round. We had nowhere to go. No green room. But anyway, he said,
turn your back.
Yeah, it's true. But he said, you do so many asides. So many of your punchlines are kind of thrown away. And he said, I've actually written a joke that I can't tell that I'm going to give to you because the punchline's an aside and I don't think I can make it work. And the joke is, I won't get it right because I haven't told it in front of a live audience yet, but the joke is 90% of Down syndrome children are aborted, which in your mind, it makes sense why the remaining 10% are always so happy. So the punchline is a throwaway, right? But it has to be told in a certain way, obviously. But he said, I think you can do that. And to me, that was a sweet joke. I'm like, oh, what a sweet joke. And he's like, how is that sweet? It's really horrible. That's what I'm telling. I'm like, because the 10% are happy. They're really smiley. I love Down syndrome people. They're adorable, right? And in fact, the Greeks wrote that handicapable people are meant to humble the soldiers. Because like you said earlier about the jocks, the proudest in society, they have a lot to live for, apparently, and need to be humbled, as far as the Greeks are concerned. When you're, what about your mother and your sister, who you're so close to, feeds your work still? What about them fed your work originally? What about them led to you became on stage? Because your act, when I first saw it in Edinburgh in 97 or 6?
Six.
Yeah. And then in 97 you won the award. Yeah. It was so extreme. And I was so happy to see something that was so vitriolic and important and so brave, because you were in a room that was about smaller than the one we're in now, which is 150 seats, and it was the humor was so severe and in your face, which is a terrible term, but it was. And what about those intimate relationships in your family have fed that for you?
Well, I guess with my mother, it was, you know, there was one of the reasons I've always loved Alan Bennett was that I saw so much of what he wrote reflected my life. In fact, I've said this before, the very first thing of his I think I saw was a play called Our Winnie, which I think I watched because it was my mother's name.
Oh, right.
And I that's the one I remember vividly,
somewhere in the 70s watching. And it's a short play about a Sunday afternoon at a crematorium. And I remember just, you know, Elizabeth Spriggs, it's about her daughter Winnie is mentally, is retarded, as you say. And it's just, you know, buttoning the big buttons on her big coat and brushing her greasy hair and wiping the corner of her mouth. And I just remember thinking, how do you know all this? It was like, it was so real.
Yeah.
And in a funny way, my mum was like, I used to write down things she said because they used to make me cry with laughter. Yeah, sort of like Mrs. Malaprop kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
One of my absolute favourites was she went to the ballet once, not long before she died, to Swan Lake. And she came back and said, did you enjoy it? She said, yes. You know, I was sitting there for half an hour thinking, why there's no talking in this? And then one of the very first, we were watching Jurassic Park and on the telly. And they got to that bit where they get out of the trucks and Sam Neill finds the sick Triceratops next to the big pile of poo, remember?
Right, right.
And it's ill because they've given it the wrong plants to eat and it's lying there. And it's basically $200 million of animatronic miracle. And I glanced up, my mum was just looking very sceptical and frowning. I said, what is it? She said, well, it's just an elephant done up. I love it.
You say the same about Liza Minnelli, can't you? Yeah.
There were so many things like that.
So funny.
But
there is something about the league that when you're watching it, as severe as some of the characters might seem, they're also very grounded. And they're very familiar, obviously, to a lot of British people.
Yes, we do. I mean, we made a big...
You pulled them way back down to earth in your
scenes.
That
was a big thing for us, though. Apart from the fact that it was a mixture of stuff, you know, there's some very silly stuff, very horror influenced stuff, stuff, but also a lot of real pathos and a kind of
physical violence too.
And yes, but also that we did. I mean, before we started working together, really, we used to I remember once me and Stephen Rees doing a sort of extended improvisation. I nearly said improv, an extended improvisation about hearing your dad's car on the gravel and getting a bit frightened about your dad coming home. And then this sort of funny thing about what those nights were like when we were all kids. We all had such a similar childhood. Oh. And the idea of having a row and then being sent to bed early and then, like, the landing door opening and your dad coming in and trying to awkwardly make peace, you know? And we just couldn't get through it for laughing because we all knew exactly what it was like.
Yeah, yeah.
So we tried very hard, the four of us, always to base it on stuff we'd known or people we'd met, but also...
Because then you can defend it in a way, can't
you?
Oh,
yes.
I find that about stand-up, that if someone comes after me, I can be like, well, that's my experience, so...
Yeah, so, you know, deal with it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Were you surprised with the response to your first show at the Fringe? Because I don't know how much you toured before that, but again, it was so different, so unusual. For one thing, there was very little group comedy.
Yeah.
At that
time. We'd been doing...
so little sketch as well.
We knew lots of... We were lucky in that sketch comedy was just kind of coming back.
Oh, right.
There'd been... Steve Coogan and John Thompson had won the Perrier a couple of years before,
right.
I think. And Armstrong and Miller were quite big.
They were doing well,
at the Fringe then. So it just felt like something was in
the
air.
And those New Zealand boys, the Concords. Yeah.
And so that was good. And then... But, you know, we'd been doing gigs here in London, living pretty much sort of hand to mouth and just keeping going and trying to generate a lot of material. And then we got to the Pleasance Attic by the skin of our teeth, the smallest venue.
But it was the best to see you there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There was sweat and screaming and that moment when the job center woman clips Rees in the... In the throat with her clipboard, and he flies out of his chair. I still get goosebumps. The show stopped for about 5 minutes. The audience was laughing so much and how you can get an audience to laugh at such a violent, that's what I found amazing. Yeah. Such a physically violent, dangerous moment when she could have killed him.
But there is a part, that is a live thing, isn't it? I mean, the next year, when we were in the Pleasance upstairs, bigger room.
When you sold out.
Then we sold out. And when the Perrier Award, that one.
Downhill from there.
But that we did Hare Lip that year. Mm. And that the climax of that, as it goes, is that the Hare Lip throws a cup of boiling water into Justin's face and then imprisons him underground as his sex slave. It's one of those shows.
Oh, that one.
Yeah. But literally every day we did that, Steve had to come out from behind the curtain with two mugs, one of which was full of genuinely steaming liquid and one which wasn't. And I used to every day think, he's going to throw it. Like throwing acid or something, you know. And something about the proxy, you know, sitting this close to someone when you do a piece of physical comedy like that, like of physical violence, it does have a visceral response. It's not the same as watching it on the TV. And people must react to that. It's kind of exciting.
Do you do much live performance? I know you did a play last year, you said, in Nottingham. But do you much live comedic performance? Or
well, we toured again last year.
Yeah, how did that go? Did you enjoy it?
It was great, yeah. I mean, we did it. We did three specials the year before last. It was essentially the anniversary of the Perrier. Mm-hmm. We were trying desperately to find a hook to put it on.
Right.
So we did three specials, and then we decided at the same time we would tour again. So we did that last summer, really. This time last year we were doing it. And it was great. I mean, really was. It was so much fun. It was like a sort of genuine time travel.
Yeah.
It was like no time had passed. We were back on the tour bus, eating crisps and watching bad horror films, and we had such a laugh. And the response was wonderful. Really very moving. None of us wanted to feel like a sort of 90s tribute tour.
Right.
So we did it because we wanted to, not because we had to. And I think everyone could tell that, you know. Mm. And it was great. And we did a lot of new stuff. We didn't just do all the old favorites.
Yeah.
And then we reversioned a few things and it was really delightful. But it was interesting to go back. When we did our first big tour, 2000-2001, which is 7 months eventually, 7 months tour, 111 shows. And that was the most sort of rock and roll we ever got, as it were. And interestingly, the Dole Scum T-shirt was always the biggest seller.
Oh, right.
That was our audience. And this time, after, you know, 20 years, the biggest seller was Les McQueen. It's a shit business. So I think our fan sort of dynamic had gone from being on the Dole to thinking that life wasn't worth living. But they still came, Scott.
Well, some comics feel like, you know, when they're young, they're like, oh my God, all the freedom I have on stage. And when they're 20 years later, they think, I'm in a cage of my own making, get me out of here, you know. But it doesn't feel that way with you guys. I feel like you're still creating. And it feels like you are not really affected. Maybe you don't even know, I don't know, about this whole woke phenomenon that's hitting live performance and comedy.
Oh, yes, we were. I mean,
about this perception that if you say something on stage, that it should be only your own personal experience, that you cannot speak outside of whatever realm has been decided by other people.
I'm very aware of that. And we had...
It's a big deal at the Fringe this
year.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. My friend Andrew, who we had on the first recording, who wrote a character called Titania McGrath on Twitter, who's doing... And he wrote the character. She's doing a live show. And she's a woke person from Islington who's quite wealthy and, you know, helping other people in her own way. But, you know, it makes me wonder... Do you like watching live comedy now? And does that perception of what should be instead of what could be affect your work? I mean, I know that on Doctor Who, the character is now female. And does this woke phenomenon, do you think, affect that choice at all?
I think it was just, I think, why not? I mean, I've personally banged the drum for it for a long time. I'm not claiming, you know, first dibs, but why not? But
there's no reason why.
Of course,
right.
The Doctor can do anything.
It's a Martian, so it can be anybody. It can be anything. It can be, right?
It's a Gallifreyan, not a Martian. the Ice Warrior is a Martian, Scott. Jesus Christ. So I don't think it's anything to do with that at all. But we were very aware last year touring again that
I mean, we only saw a tiny bit of this on Twitter. It wasn't like anyone demonstrated, but it was clear that to some sections of the younger section of this audience who might have been dragged along by their unwilling parents, we were essentially like Bernard Manning.
Right.
And they couldn't fucking believe what they were
saying. Yes, I know what you mean. Yeah. I don't know if you know, but Sarah Silverman was just let go from a film, and she claims to have been let go from the film the night before she was meant to shoot because of a blackface sketch she did on her sitcom in 2007. Right. And there's been a lot of talk up in Edinburgh in the last 2 weeks about what people should and shouldn't say. When I was there last year doing a solo show, I had a lot of young women come and review me. And one joke I told that was a lead-in to talk about the new married couple in the Royals was a joke about Lady Diana, which was a joke that was current, but about Lady Diana. And she spent about a paragraph talking about how old my act seemed and how dusty I was. Now, my fear as a live comic is to be thought of as something stale or dated, right? So I intentionally write, I do a show at the Comedy Store on Tuesdays. It's a political improv show. And a lot of that material I put into my Edinburgh shows because I want the show, like you said, to seem contemporary. But I do have very little patience for people that go to a comedy club hoping to not have their minds changed.
Do you know what it is? I mean, what it is complicated. And we live in unnuanced times. So
That's a lovely diplomatic way of saying it. You've been working in TV for a while, haven't you?
We live in
it's true, though. It's, yeah.
So
you mean the audience lacks the new... The
everything is incredibly
nuance.
Black and white.
Right.
But life is extremely gray. But the perception, the perception people want of it is that it's all very much this way.
Like it's a war.
Way. Yeah. Oh yes, it is a war.
You've got to pick a side.
We are in a civil war. We'll come on to that in a minute. But I think it's very, very difficult because, of course, for me, fundamentally, comedy has to be disreputable because it's in the gap between expectation and result, or that something happens. The reason you laugh at someone falling on their face is because it's not you, and you know it's painful. But you laugh. Of course you do. It's your first instinct.
Right.
So any policing of that is extremely frightening, and yet, of course, that doesn't mean that you can just have someone standing on this stage saying whatever what they like. Because
although that should be allowed,
yeah, well, no, but I mean that's the difference. What I mean is,
you don't. Not everyone has to like that.
Yeah,
right.
But
comedy, I always think, is an argument that no one wins. Comedy should be a battle that no one really has the closing answer for.
Listen, I saw your Anne Frank routine.
Do you know? Okay, not in defense of that, but when I wrote that, I was in Amsterdam because I'm brave. In the front lines. But I wrote it because I'd gone, and I did walk in thinking, you know, where are the rides? And when I told the bartender that at the bar I was working at, he said, that's funny. So I presented it, and the audience got really worked up and angry. Now, this is why I am not on TV regularly in any country, because when the audience got annoyed with me, and the club owner threatened to fire me at Toomler's in Amsterdam on that weekend, I thought, clearly, I've got to write more material about this. I've got to clear this mess up. And when I took the bit to the Edinburgh Fringe that year, I thought, I thought that was the one part of the act that people would complain about because it was stale. I thought, well, it's been 50 years. Obviously, this has been covered, right? The one part I thought I'd get called a hack about was that. But it was the opposite. It's weird, isn't it? I mean, in a way, I'm fucked up. But also, I think my brain screwed up from an old accident. But also, I think this is what makes a comic the one on stage, because you're the one that can see humor in something that most people cannot find an answer for. Mm. And humor solves so many misconceptions, I think.
Well, and that's why, but we're in such a humorless time. I mean, you know, on Orwell's grave, it says, I told you
on
so.
On whose grave? Orwell's grave, yeah.
It just says, I told you so. Because he's right about everything.
Everything.
Everything. Everything. Everything.
And it's like Star Trek. How did they predict all this? They got the iPhones right and everything.
Only
is
Orwell had written for Star Trek.
Yeah.
Maybe you did. But it, I mean,
Captain Kirk has his shirt off
to an incredible extent in terms of you know, thought crime, sex crime, newspeak, fake news. Obviously,
well, hype. It's exactly media hype. The whole
Winston
thing. Yeah.
Smith's job is to alter the past.
Right.
It's all there, and we, you know, we've all known it since the book came out. But it's frightening how.
And since William Randolph Hearst, who used to create wars in the Chronicle in San Francisco, but you know, but I do expect when they pay. And they give up an evening, and they find a sitter, and they park the car, and they go through all that trouble, and they walk in. I do think that that's a social contract.
But is it not the fact that genuinely most people, this would explain why most people like sort of Nando's,
is that... Oh, God, the tone in your voice when you say
what they actually want is sort of warm pap. They don't really want to be challenged at all.
But why would you... writing Sherlock, Doctor Who, and The League have such a large audience then? That's what I wonder. Because I'm wondering what in your life allows you to find a way to make what you like accessible to a room full of strangers that don't know who you are?
Well, it's not, I mean, it's, I hope, because it's not warm pap, but it's not unchallenging. It's just, it's also just about, I think it's about trying to have an eye on what's popular, but not in a cynical way. I mean, I tried to make stuff that I'd like to watch. That's the absolute.
But who knew Sherlock would be popular? Oh, who knew?
Well, I mean, it's.
It's had a long history, obviously, but who knew that now young people would be thrilled
And
by.
You could not.
It's huge in Russia. It's not, huge. Yeah. Or in Brazil.
And China.
China, right. Yeah. Everything's huge in China, though. Yeah. They got a lot of people. Yeah. But yes, it is. And my husband's a ginormous fan of yours from having seen the show in Brazil.
It's hot, right?
But, you know, I wonder, it takes a certain kind of perception to make that sort of, that leap from an idea to something that popular that's not been noticed by people for such a long time.
I mean, because if nobody knows anything, and if you could bottle it, you'd do it straight away again, wouldn't you? But I mean, we were completely blown away. It'll never happen again. I mean, that's, for me, that's...
Well, Dracula might. It might be the same, right?
But it might. But if it's even half as popular, that's quite something. But Sherlock is just one of those things where all the stars align. You just can't.
But Dracula has sex and blood in it.
It's true.
It's good.
We did have a very amusing... I won't name it. We had to go to a country to try and sell Dracula a few months ago. And
are you on the road selling that show country to country?
No. There was one particular country we had to try and persuade.
The US.
And by the time we got there,
they didn't know who Dracula was.
No. Well, sort of. Yes. Yeah. Amazingly, you just assume a general knowledge.
You'd be surprised in America.
And secondly, it wasn't America. All right. And secondly,
Canada.
Top of their list of things which were forbidden on TV were sex, the supernatural, and what was the other one? Sex, supernatural. So anyway, it was just basically Dracula.
Right. Yeah. So it's not going to work out for that country.
It's never going to sell. South Sudan. All right.
I don't know why you have it in for South Sudan. But listen, it was, you know, when you want to do something, where in your mind do you start? I mean, when you get hooked on an idea, and you think, I've got to write this, how does that nucleus begin in your head? Do you come at it from a horror perspective or a comedy perspective, or are they in your mind the same, very similar?
I'm editing my new Christmas ghost story now, which is a particular joy of mine. I've directed this one. It's my third one,
for
BBC Four.
Okay,
and you know, it's an M.R. James adaptation. It's one of my favorite stories. But I know it's inflected with humor, but as M.R. James was, and actually, but I know I can't ever quite get away from it. In fact, I've just cut a line today because I thought it was too funny for the flavor of the scene.
Oh, right.
But I put it in on the day because it made me laugh, you know. So, you know, it's like, but I think there's two ways of coming at things all the time.
Yeah.
And equally, you know, and I did a series of monologues for BBC Four a couple of years ago called Queers for the anniversary the 50th anniversary of the decriminalisation, and I wrote this monologue for Ben Whishaw, and it's one of my favourite things. I loved it, and it came out. The whole series came out very well, and I was very proud of it. But the strangest thing was, to my great surprise, I couldn't find any jokes in it. It's about a First World War soldier. It's called The Man on the Platform, and I really surprise myself that at no stage in the writing or making of it, it's very, very, very serious.
But was any of it, after you watch it now, does any of it seem humorous to you now?
No, it's just, that's almost unique in my recent experience of a thing where I was quite proud of myself because I thought I haven't found a sort of easy
laugh. Well, I was going to say, that must have felt refreshing for you in a way.
It was interesting. I couldn't quite work out what it was that was different.
I'm trying to write a serious piece for next year's Edinburgh. I didn't go up this year because I didn't really have anything I wanted to say. But I want to talk about, I saw a comic last year from Australia mention, we have to talk about consent, one of those trigger words, on a woke comedy stage. And although I adore him, I thought that he was being weak and cowardly by not writing jokes about it. But I thought consent, in so many ways, is such an interesting idea. So I'm trying to write an hour-long kind of serious piece about consent. But I assume that in flushing it on a stage, flushing it or fleshing it, whichever you want to choose, that it will, humor will approach, humor will approach me. And like you said about that line you stuck in, that I will have to. Because maybe who you feel this way about yourself, I definitely feel that. Unless there's some humor in what I'm doing, it's basically me at a podium, waving my finger at people, barking orders at them. My husband has corrected me, and he just did it in Budapest before I went on, because it was a huge Spiegel tent with 500 people in it. He said, remember, they're young, don't lecture them. And the minute he said, Kapuro, the minute I hear numbers, because if I start going 98% of, because I start getting, I grew up.
We remember that as famous, isn't it, when Lenny Bruce was so...
Oh, that's what I grew up watching him. Yeah. Listen, I have bootleg tapes of Lenny Bruce recorded in San Francisco when he's describing the word dyke to an audience that still thinks it's a wall in Holland. And he spends a long time describing words to people so that they get the joke. That's where I started. That's why I find... Describing dykes. Yeah. Making fun of dykes if you can. But also, if you can describe more, let them in more of who you are, they find the jokes are funnier. Mm. Although, like you said earlier, I think some people don't like that. They want a mirror held up to show them how wonderful they are. Hmm. But I do
But you know, there's that famous thing. He was eventually sort of just reeling out statistics and someone just
from
said,
court cases.
You're not funny anymore, man. Yeah. It's like the devastating.
Which is
to
the
say.
Toughest tackle you can get, I think. If someone says not funny.
Yeah.
I think comics can deal with a lot, except not that one. But I remember watching him in that film, and then with the tape and thinking, there's so many things about this that are so brilliant. And why is he still portrayed and remembered so favorably by so many people, so loved? But I think, anyway, I want to imagine that in this world, that comedy, that sounds so, hippy-dippy, but I do want comedy to sort of unite people against people like Trump. I mean, I think that we can deal with someone like Donald Trump if we can continue to make jokes about him.
The only thing is, I mean, people have been declaring satire dead since the fall of the Roman Empire and past, but it's very hard when everything... There's a great cartoon in The New Yorker a couple of years ago, and there's a cartoonist, New Yorker cartoonist doing a Trump cartoon, and his wife's in the doorway just says, he just did it. And just like that, isn't there?
No, he does write jokes faster than we do. No, he does, I know. And he's a comic.
Yeah.
He is a stand-up. I mean, I know.
So you get... I mean, it's all we've got to laugh, really, but because everything is so... It's perhaps... I mean, I alternate between wild despair and really wild despair.
But how did you cope with Brexit in your show last year, which I'm sure that it surfaced its ugly, reared many heads.
We did. Well, we had some fun.
I'm assuming that you're not in favor of leaving the EU.
You are very much correct.
Thank you. It's nice to hear. I've lost friendships over it.
Have you really? I'm a great...
I'm an EU national, so I take it personally, some of
it. I'm a great Civil War fan. Mm. The English Civil War is my favorite period.
Oh, that one.
Yeah, the last one. And there are genuinely very strong parallels. Mm. This is a roundhead cavalier thing.
Mm.
It's Parliament versus people who call themselves Brexiteers. The fact that they use that fucking word glibly, as if it's actually
it's so
the real
smug.
World, as if they're twiddling their moustaches, and there's something sort of roguish, and that Johnst, of course, typifies the whole Jesus thing of it, that the entitled, smug, smirking.
But aren't they worried about what happened in the last one could happen in this?
Well, that he'll have his head cut. It'll take a while.
To cut the head off or to get that up?
To get there.
He's so thick-skinned.
But But it has divided families and friendships, yeah, just as that did in the 17th century. And it's a pernicious thing. The comparison I always make, it's like the incredible thing. It's like slitting your own throat and then going to bed and saying, I'll see how I am in the morning. It's so crazy.
And so many people that confuse alcoholism with activism. So many of my friends who suddenly became political activists. I'm like, what about your Oxbridge education made you think that you can make this decision for the rest of us? Because that's what you're doing with your vote. That's what you're doing. You're voting me out. You're voting me off the island.
What there is, genuinely, you see, there is a mass... What they're doing, like all populist movements do, is ruthlessly exploit a genuine grievance. There is an underclass in this country, and one thing that touring the country again last year really showed me, there's a great swathe of this country have been totally forgotten.
And they're very angry about
and
it.
They're very
and they
angry.
Have every right to
Unfortunately,
be.
Unfortunately, the people they have invested their faith in are completely cynical.
And are about to screw the hell out of them.
And about to screw them even worse. And that's where we are. So it's a legitimate response. It's people who feel incredibly powerless finally thinking they've got some voice, and they did,
right,
but they voted, their turkeys voting for Christmas is the worst possible thing you can do.
I think that it's difficult giving a referendum, a direct vote to people in a parliamentary democracy, which is designed to slim down people's rights. And so to suddenly offer them this, and they can direct their anger at someone or something which happens at that moment to be the EU, all their anger is going to go in that direction.
Yeah.
It was, in a way, a brilliant strategy from these people we don't so much admire. Maybe they saw that.
Oh, definitely. It's.
But how thick was Cameron to give them that chance? It's so disturbing.
But I spoke to someone who had worked with him, who was there at the last EU. Now, let's put this in context.
I brought it up kind of because I know that you hang out with a lot of the... I'm just saying.
Oh, who?
Well, Mark, where you live, you have a Victorian laboratory in your cellar.
No, I don't.
The people that you are with whom you are conjoined professionally, I'm imagining that you bump heads with these sorts of people all the time. I know some of them. I wave at them from down here, and I know who they are. And I wonder how you cope with that in your professional life.
Do you mean like Tories?
Not just Tories, because a lot of Tories are opposed to leaving the EU as well.
Who do you mean? The establishment?
Yes.
No,
people,
I don't.
People that are just rolling in it, that are going to make so much money at this.
I just stay at home. I can't be bothered to go out. It's absolutely true.
Really?
It takes a lot to get me out of the house. You're very lucky.
Oh, well, I kept checking Twitter today for the message. When I saw you on there, I'm like, oh, he's going to cancel. But I really appreciate it. But you know, I'm not a diplomatic person, which is, again, another reason why, you know, my career's in the situation it's in. But I wonder when I watch and see you in those interviews, I think, how does he, coming from a queer working class background and with I'm sure a family that had a very strong political viewpoint, and here you are, and your politics are expressed in almost everything you do. It's undeniable how you feel and think about things. And how do you sit at that table?
Well, I don't. Honestly, I don't. I mean, I've never been to Downing Street or anything like that. I wouldn't.
Really?
No.
Have you shaken her hand?
The Queen?
Yes.
No? And I honestly... This is
You've been invited?
No.
Never?
And I would never, ever accept any of those stupid...
They're so
things.
Depressing. When I see them on TV, I have to turn them off. I just can't watch it.
Listen, who's the most famous person to ever get an OBE? Jimmy Savile. And a knighthood. Let's leave that there. I just don't, I have no interest, genuinely no interest whatsoever in that. I don't care if it gets you a better restaurant and table and restaurant. I just not interested. So I don't, honestly, I don't. And I
you don't feel the need to?
Not at all. I really can't be bothered.
But the BBC is run by some of these people, and you're employed.
Oh, of course
by
it
them.
Is. But then, I mean, I don't mix in those circles. I mean, I didn't go to Oxbridge or anything. I know it's still absolutely perniciously there.
Yeah.
That the idea that people are judged by which college they went to, never mind which university they went to, which college within the university they went to, stuff like that. It's incredibly. But
you went to art school.
Huh?
You went to an art
school? I went to a
drama school.
Terrible drama school, yeah.
Right. Well, you met the boys.
Yeah.
Which is a good luck, right?
Yeah, amazing.
Right.
It was, in so many ways, it was the foundation of everything. It was slightly in adversity because we were so depressed by our course, we started doing our own stuff. That's what I forget.
But maybe having gone there also, it helps you sort of remain who you are.
Yes, I hope so. And also, but you know, God. I mean, I feel...
The British are obsessed with it right now, and I think a lot of the world would like a lot of British people to calm down about it a little bit.
But it's understandable when it's, I think, it's a sort of class war. It's at its most extreme that it's been.
But I'm asking you, which side do you take? Oh. Because you are from both classes.
I'm not.
Well, you are.
Well, I've become middle class, definitely.
Middle class in this country is funny.
From being working class.
Because people
say
middle class. Well, yes. But people say middle class here, and they mean something else. Most people who say it. My arms are crossed right now. I'm not being defensive. But I will say this. I grew up with my mother, and my father left when I was two. My only memory of him as a child is him lifting me up and then putting me back down again because I threw up on him. And that still goes on. Anyway, so... But he's still alive, sitting in his garage right now, smoking and drinking whiskey, which sounds fantastic, and not spending any of his money on any of us. My sister's with him. It's almost separated our family because she has to look after him. She's like, you know, we can't let him drive. I'm like, oh, let him drive. But anyway, let's get this over with. But my father's family had a lot of money, and my mother's didn't, although they pretended to. So I had a lot of pretense growing up. I had working class, upper class. And I noticed when I came here that the British refer to middle class who are upper class. They are. There is the middle class in this country might have existed in the 90s or the noughties, but now I just think middle class people are wealthy.
Oh, well.
In the UK, in London especially.
But I suppose that's not the same as being, properly posh. That is still.
Like a hyphenated name. Yeah. I don't think that.
Still very different.
Do you battle with it in your work at all? Do you find yourself struggling to represent in some way everybody so you can get everyone's word in there so you can make sure that this piece or what you've written or this humor piece doesn't seem in some way jaded or laden with some sort of one-sided political message?
No, I mean, I tried to, I mean, the problem I think is, for me, is I'm not an activist. I have very strong political opinions, but I don't have any interest in going on stuff like Question Time because...
God, you'd be brilliant.
No, I wouldn't because the point is, and I've said this so many times, in the end, I'm just a man in a pub. There are so...
There's room for that on Question Time as well.
That's the problem with this fucking country. That's what we have politicians for. We have elected representatives. That's why we don't have referenda. We have elected representatives who do this boring, difficult stuff for us to try and get the bins out on time and get people's dentist appointments on time. The really tough stuff. That's what politicians are good at. But there are lots of men in the pub who think they know how to run the world. And they're all, as they are every single week on Question Time, embarrassed when someone starts talking about Gaza. And they look like what they are, which is idiots, mouthy idiots. And I do not want to be that. And secondly, as my husband's always saying to me, unless you're actually going to take up arms or literally quit and go and work for Médecins Sans Frontières, then what are you going to do about it?
God, that's so weird because I had an American...
You're going to do that?
Well, just for the outfit. But some American friends were visiting last year and were going off about Trump, California rich people. And what about my children? And Trump, and how horrible it's become. And they were here for 2 weeks staying in a five-star hotel. And this woman who I went to university with, I said to her, you know, isn't it refreshing, though, to know that in a way your vote really doesn't matter? I only said that because in California we know who's going to win. They don't even come out to California to campaign anymore because it's such a liberal state.
Yeah, yeah.
And she grabbed her knife and came across the table at me in Covent Garden. This woman my age, who I could have taken, came at me with a knife. And I'm like, Anne! She's like, I threw it down. And since then, my husband has noted, has not returned any of my messages. The friends she knows don't talk to me now.
Because you said her vote was meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh.
And in a way, I think, you know, unless you're willing to fight the battle on the front lines, keep it to yourself. Mm. And really stop with the alligator or crocodile, whichever ones they are, tears. Stop. You're fine. And in a way, I wonder, I agree with you, because in a way, whoever is in office is not really going to affect you. It won't affect you. It might affect some of your family, but not you. Right? So pick up an axe?
The thing is, you end up genuinely, you let in so much craziness into your head that you can't exist. I mean... There is not a single day that goes by without Brexit having an impact on all our mental health.
But I worry about the homophobia that I feel rising again.
Yeah. But that's, see, that's to me, where I, bothers but that's me. The battle. That's yes. the thing, isn't it? Because then you can't, if you just ignore it, then they've won.
Yes, I feel the same way.
But you've got to, then you've got to work out the extent to which you actually engage and actually what can you do? What can you do?
What was a female Doctor Who? That's what I'm asking. Was that some way you fighting it?
No, because it's nothing to do with me. I don't.
But women's rights and gay men's rights go hand in manicured hand, I think. They do.
Yeah, but I don't write for Doctor Who anymore, so it wasn't my decision.
And why don't you write for Doctor Who anymore?
Oh, well, I was very much because of working so closely with Stephen, who was running Doctor Who, and I was in Peter Capaldi's last story,
right,
playing the grandson of one of my favorite characters from the 70s, playing the Brigadier.
You've ticked
grandson.
So many boxes,
yeah,
haven't you?
I mean, literally every box I've got. And I felt I'd reached my natural end, you know. And also Chris Chibnall took over, wanted a great new influx of people. There is a season to everything.
Yes, sure.
So it was, I thought it was just time to, I've had my fun.
I saw some documentary footage of you backstage.
Oh, yeah.
Or on set, but not filming. Enjoy, like a child, so happy on Christmas morning, touching all the props.
What was that?
Playing with the actors. And you spoke to one of the behind-the-scenes people, and he was some young, beautiful guy that you put your arm around and said hello
to. That's
why. Yes. And you were in costume, and you were just joyous. It was great to see you, so happy. How does your husband compliment you? Usually couples. My husband...
He just says, you look beautiful.
Well, there's that. And he doesn't have to, you do. But it's nice to hear, isn't it? But we were at a dinner party recently, and a couple I adore, I know her from yoga, you expect her to be liberal. Anyway, start talking about how the Jews are everywhere. And my husband, and I start saying, oh, they are, and they should be, shouldn't they? They should be allowed everywhere. I started to find the joke. There was no joke. And this is after he told us why he doesn't, you know, rent to black people, because you can't, they have small brains, they're like children. Anyway... In San Francisco. Anyway, my husband grabbed my leg with his hand, and we were having dinner at their house. We were their guests, and grabbed my leg really hard to shut me the fuck up and get me out of there. And in a way, I think my husband's politics are much more conservative than my own. But he also, he's from Brazil, so, you know, put him in a prison and lock the doors. But I think
that's a new policy, isn't it?
And it's also the name of my next one-person show. But he calms my reaction. And we will walk, every time we walk into a party or a social function, he'll whisper in my ear, be nice. Which I need to hear, because I'm a comic who knew I was queer when I was 5 and then hid it from 8 to 16. So I know how to protect myself by being a bit of a prick, just a bit of a prick, a little bit. Because not everybody wants to be made fun of, right? And I do that. So in what way does your husband...
It's quite similar in a way, I think, in the... he worries about my blood pressure, but then because he's always trying to...
Is it high?
Calm me. No, but it could get high.
you never know, right? Do you know how you're going to die?
Today, I think.
Have you imagined?
No, I fear death more than anything still.
But you are enamored with it as well, aren't
yes,
you?
Yes, yes. Much less so than I used to be. As a sort of gothy child, of course, every teenager is in love with death. Mm. And the paraphernalia of it all. But much the closer I get to it, less and less. Really? And I find my taste for all that sort of stuff has changed. So people, you know, did you see that show Penny Dreadful?
Yeah, of course.
Well, I didn't. Because
but
people say, oh, yeah, that's just up your street. And I go, you know, it's so much up my street, I can't bear to watch it. And there are loads of things like that these days that I simply just don't have any interest
in. I can't watch The Handmaid's Tale. I can't watch
it. Well, that's because it's a live feed from the White House.
Yeah.
And I have the same thing. One of my absolute favorite things always were counterfactuals. I ate and drank them. I loved reading, oh, what if Russia had won... this? What if the Nazis won the Second World War? I love all that. Loads of famous...
And there's that series on now, that as if the Nazis had won.
Yes, but that's the thing. But now I can't watch them. I didn't watch Man in the High Castle, Handmaid's Tale, SSGB, because I think like we're in them. In fact, the Nazis did win. That's
well, the Germans, arguably...
Germans are the good guys this time.
Well, and you know, they did the best out of the war. They did, didn't they? I mean, if you go to Berlin now, it looks like Washington, D.C., the way they've redesigned it, because there's so much American money in it. So
Yeah, so he, my husband...
yeah,
Ian,
did you expect...
You met him
online.
Yeah, yeah. Before it was vaguely fashionable.
Right.
In fact, it was in those days, it was quite creepy.
Wasn't it? People were embarrassed to announce it in audiences.
We used to actually...
And now they do.
You and I remember a time when you had to write it on a piece of paper and burn it up the chimney. That's how it used to
be. So to speak. Yeah. you did. No, but you're right. I mean, the way, you know, I used to bump into you in the pool around the corner from mm-hmm. here, which is quite cruising in those days. I don't know what it's like now. I've been there years. But I used to...
Not me.
Yeah, I used to
Oasis.
Think, yeah, the Oasis. Yeah. But I used to think... I used to go there with... You know, I wanted to swim because I love swimming, but I also had... I liked watching boys in bathing suits and stuff. I do miss all that sort of intentional cruising, which now if you make eye contact with someone... They behave as though that you want to rape them or murder them. It's so strange now.
That's just because they recognize you from the right stuff.
Right. And they know my history. But also, I think it's because people grow up looking down at a screen now. So eye contact is almost threatening to them, I think.
I don't know. Because I'm torn permanently between thinking, is this just what always happens? So there is a version of you and I complaining about young people looking at screens.
Right.
Which our parents had about us looking at.
Comic screens. Although I complain about people my age doing it too.
Yeah. Well, there is that sort of zombification.
Yeah.
I read somewhere recently they're putting in some new sort of traffic lights which alert people before they cross the road to look up from their phone because so many people are getting knocked down.
Yes, they are. It's really, and I think it's a problem with live performance too.
Yeah.
I mean, people have gone, famously ran up on the stage during a Broadway production to charge their phones during a show because there's a fake plug painted into a wall.
No!
It's happening a lot.
That's amazing. They should be murdered.
Hilarious. And Patti LuPone has killed a few. That's why she's not.
Yes. But, I went to. I went to. You see Company? I know, but you know, I didn't see Bibles.
It was delicious. You know, it was she was fantastic.
Saw it twice. She was so great. But we went to. There was an.
I read what you thought about it too.
Oh,
it was interesting that.
So
that you admire that production so much. I liked it. I thought there were some problems. With her being a woman, and I can't remember what they were, and I wish that no problem in the music, but they could have structured the script to suit her a bit more. I think it would have, I think a bit more layer around her would have been nice. But anyway, it was a fantastic. We fucking loved it. It was great.
And Patti LuPone, I mean, that's something else, isn't it? But there was
she spilled her drink all over the front row.
Q&A.
Her martini went everywhere. Amazing.
There's a Q&A after the last one. I think it was the last one. Oh, nearly anyway. And Paddy O'Connell. Was chairing it, and he said, "Patty, how does it feel singing this sleazy song?"
Sleazy?
So, no, I don't really mean sleazy. She absolutely wouldn't let it go. It was hilarious. And it was like the second question, and he just completely
couldn't
went
go
to
with it. Yeah, yeah.
As you would.
Yeah.
What are you, sleazy?
Yeah. Why? Because she's drunk. Is what
he
meant.
Like a loud drunk in a bar. Maybe.
But there's nothing really sexual about this song.
No.
Deem it a bit sleazy. And you're loving, I did want to ask you though, you're loving living together?
Yes. Well, you know, it's 20 years next month.
Since you met him?
Yeah.
No, it has.
Yes, it is. 20 years.
That's
and
too long. You shouldn't tell people that. And yes, and?
And it was also our 12th civil partnership anniversary. And Ryan wrote in his card, 20 years and still laughing.
See?
To bring it rather nicely full circle.
Let's get out of here. So wait, Mark's saying, yes, Game of Thrones in it. And you're great in Game of Thrones, by the way. But did you enjoy doing it? You didn't write on Game of Thrones. And how did you enjoy playing a part that you hadn't had anything with creating?
Loved it. I mean, I'd never seen the show before I did it. I knew everyone was talking about it. I got offered this part. I did 4 or 5 episodes, and I love kind of not having any investment. It was great fun. Everyone was lovely. Huge production values. Like, I went to Ireland and Croatia.
Oh my God.
And just dipping my toe in it as this minor character. People everywhere I go will ask, well, before the series ended, would ask me all these detailed questions. I just go,
I don't know.
But I like that because, especially with, you know, growing up with Doctor Who and knowing so many things in sort of TV and science fiction and horror so intimately, to not know anything was really refreshing. I felt like one of those actors I used to read interviews with in Doctor Who magazine
who, you know, they'd find someone who was in an episode in the 60s, and they'd sort of say, well, I remember the pub Patrick Troughton took us to, and it was all gobbledygook, but it was lovely. And it was like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just didn't have a clue.
Yeah.
And in fact, towards the end, someone said, I was on a red carpet something, and someone said, who do you think is going to be the Iron Throne? And I just went, me.
Yeah.
It's the only person I could think of.
Are you thinking of adopting?
You?
I need to be. Actually, I can't. Yeah, I can't afford my father.
No, thank you.
But
no.
Yeah,
we have a lovely dog. He's.
But
he's
whose mind are you going to shape? The way you're going to shape yours.
Oh, his. Very much.
All right.
we shaved him and put him in a little pullover.
It doesn't get any creepier than that. Mark Gatiss, thank you so much. We'd love to have you back at some point.
Let's do part three.
You're a fantastic.
I've missed
that.
Part two's been wiped.
Yes. That's the name of my second one person. Anyway, thank you so much.
Thanks, love.
That was the incredible, dynamic, dynamite Mark Gatiss speaking with us. You can find this show on Twitter under Scott Capurro. I'll be posting it all over social media, including Facebook under Scott Capurro. And we'll have our own platform. I'll let you know that soon. In the meantime, tune in next time for our hopefully female guest. I've been desperate to get a woman's on the show, and hopefully Shappi Korsandi or Carrie Godleman or someone of that nature will join us with their brilliance. Thanks so much for tuning in. And this is again Scott Capurro with whatever the show is called. Thank you. Bye.